Well, as we approach this passage again and look at it once more, four differences that we need to bear in mind between the world of Deuteronomy chapter 24 and our world now. Now, these are differences which, far from reducing the relevance of Deuteronomy 24, in actual fact, heighten the relevance of Deuteronomy 24. Instead of making it an obscure Old Testament text, it actually brings it bang up to date, and it connects very strongly with us as we read it. So, Israel and the church and the world. Israel was to be different from the world. All of these laws were to mark them out as being quite distinct in ancient Near Eastern culture, and very different indeed from the Canaanites and the other Sevenites, or the other Sixites, that occupied the territory. Different not simply in terms of their conduct, but different in terms of their rationale, their thinking, their motivation, everything. And the New Testament Israel, the people of God, the children of promise, as Paul calls us in Galatians, the church, is to be in exactly the same way distinctive from the culture around us. So we not only do things differently and treat each other differently, but we have a completely different motivation for the way that we treat each other. So Israel, yes, is not the church in national sense. So we're not talking here about primarily as if we could point the finger at our godless nation and say, tut, tut. We take Israel as God's people, God's old covenant people, and we see, well, actually, we are the continuation of that people. And a time will come when God draws so many of these from this nation back to himself that it looks like all Israel will be saved. When we read that in Romans, we need to take the word all in its context. So Israel, the church, and the world, there's a distinction between us and Israel. Yes, Israel was a nation where the church, Israel was a political entity with armies. Israel was given civil laws in the way that the church is not. So Israel was given sanctions that could be enforced against lawbreakers in the way that the church is not, because we are commanded to live within the laws of the land as far as they do not cause us to sin against God. But Israel of old and the church now stands over against the world. Old covenant, new covenant. This is the old covenant which people fail to meet, fail to deliver on. But everything that God is teaching his people here was fulfilled in the new covenant man, in Jesus Christ. And therefore, as we live his life, as we find his righteousness imparted to us day by day, we find ourselves doing the stuff that this talks about from within. So we have then the law. This is only three distinctions, isn't it? Three differences, not four. If you're looking for a fourth, stop. In the Old Covenant, the law was being impressed upon the people from the outside, so to speak. It was an external constraint. But now in the New Covenant, the Spirit has been poured out. The promise of God is that he will change our hearts, that he will pour his Spirit upon us, that he will put his Spirit within us and cause us to walk in his ways. So we find that the life that is lived by the Spirit, in actual fact, becomes from within a life that fulfills what those under the weight of the law could never do. So we are empowered by the Spirit as those who live in New Covenant days, united with the New Covenant man, to be as distinct from the world as Israel was, in pretty much the same ways as Israel was meant to be, at least. So bear all that in mind. This is about us. This is about the life lived in the power of the Spirit. This is about life lived in the new man, the last Adam, the one in whom the new covenant is fulfilled. So let's take the laws. We were thinking on Sunday morning about the commentary, the key to this passage and the surrounding ones, as being the new commandment in John 13, 34, 35, 34, 35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you. By this will all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another, as we sing. You'll be delighted that I didn't sing it to you this evening, but if you want, I could later. Let's this evening take something which belongs to the same sphere of thought. Let's take another New Testament verse, Hebrews 10:24. As a comment on this and a comment on what the fulfillment of the 11th commandment actually looks like in practice. If you just turn to Hebrews, Hebrews 10, you'll find it on, if you've got one of our church Bibles, on page 1208. This is the passage, 10:19-25, which you do with a children's address with some lettuces. As the visual aid, because it keeps saying lettuce, 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 you see. And so you have these lettuces and you pin something on each lettuce. Good. Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain, that is his body, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart, in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience, and having our bodies washed with pure water. Let us draw near to God with the sincere heart. Let us, as those who draw near to God, so this is the question of integrity between what you are, you know, the rest of the time and what you are when you pray. Okay, this is the disciple who has integrity between the two. So the drawing near to God with a sincere heart, verse 22, that mentality carries on. This is also how we should be who draw near to God. Let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess, for he who promises faithful, and let us consider how we may spur one another on towards love and good deeds. And it is that love and good deeds thing. It is the fact that if we're obeying the 11th commandment and loving one another as Christ has loved us, then that love will show in action, it will show in good deeds, it will show in how we treat one another. So that's why I'm taking 10:24 here as another helpful key to another helpful handle on this passage. If the people are going to love each other, then these are the kind of good deeds that God expects to see. And he wants them to love each other, because we've already seen on Sunday mornings back in chapter 6 that the law is summed up in love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. So here is some of the loving your neighbor as yourself thing. This is what love and good deeds are like. So, first of all, encouraging love in the home, verses 1 through 5. Verses 1 through 4, protecting the institution of marriage. So it's not protecting what our current culture, we're talking about the contrast between the church and the world here, the difference. It's not protecting what our culture tells us to protect, which is the rights of the individual, so to speak. It's not telling us that, you know, we're not to read this as either husbands or wives, men or women, who are asking the question, what does this do for me? Because what God is protecting here is marriage per se. He is protecting, if you like, the institution of marriage, and therefore all marriages. Our minds tend to gravitate upon what's protecting me, please. How am I being spoken of in these verses? What is this about? This doesn't seem to be elevating me at all. In actual fact, when we think individualistically like that, we're already breaking our marriages apart. I have to say that I've taken weddings, parish weddings here very rarely, much more in Dundee, where I've spent time with a couple beforehand. We've had the wedding. I've spoken about these things as clearly as I can, and even sometimes during the service, and other people listening have known what I've been talking about, but I've watched a bride and groom walk out as two individuals who happen to have been in the same place going through the same ceremony, and they're not one. And they're still thinking individualistically. Now, it is the institution of marriage, and therefore all marriages, contra our selfish instinct, that's being protected here. And being protected in this way, verses 1 through 4, inhibit what I call the chattelization of others, or indeed oneself. What does that mean? Well, chattels are goods. Chattels are movable property, right? Movable property. Things that you can take with you or pass on to other people. Just things. And what's happening, if people do the thing which this commandment prohibits, what's happening is that both the wife and the husband, as wife and husband, as partners in a marriage, are becoming chattel, to be moved around from place to place. And the question of the standing before God of the person, which is what makes us so unique in all creation as human beings, is completely sublimized. So what we have here is this woman being moved around or moving herself around as an item to be, put within a marriage. Now, just be careful to note, as we did on Sunday, that the defiled of verse 4 is not a reference to her having been remarried and then divorced again and becoming married again. That's not the defilement, and that cannot be the case because, of course, verse 3 is very careful to say, or if he dies, and it still applies. So it cannot be a second divorce, which means that she's defiled. And what we don't have in the English, but is in the Hebrew, is that the second half of verse 4 begins, she would be detestable in the eyes of the Lord. Now, if it was the man who was remarrying her again, it would be the man, and the problem lay in the remarrying per se, it would be the man who was defiling, who was doing the detestable thing. But it's the woman, in this case, and the defilement, therefore, refers back to something indecent. That hasn't been dealt with before God. A certificate of divorce has been written. She's been put out of the house. She's gone and married somebody else so that she's got a roof over her head and an income or something, and, you know, some security. And either that person divorces her or he dies, but she's in the mentality that God is inhibiting and prohibiting here, she's on the market again. And she's not just to go back and to be a person moved around from marriage to marriage as if she's a thing. And she's not to treat herself like that. And the man's not to be complicit in that and allow that to happen, her first husband. There's an issue before God. And that is an essentially humanizing way to approach things. So that we're not objects that move around. Now, how does our modern world read that? Well, our modern world totally recoils at the notion of anybody being defiled. It just recoils at that. But far more insidiously, our culture, our society now, has this autonomy thing. You know, I rule myself. So I can do what I want. I can go where I want. I can sell myself to the highest bidder or the lowest bidder. I can do what I like. Now, the problem is that in doing that, we devalue ourselves. In saying, I must be allowed to do what I want to do, ironically, we do not value the human being. We devalue human beings because we then start being guided by our sinful nature. We start being moved around by other people's sinful nature. Aside from the marriage bond question, just think how that works in a far lesser situation, in one sense, with respect to going out with people. You know, when someone dumps somebody, it's a dehumanizing thing. Or if someone just walks away from relationships and walks into another one with a totally casual attitude because they want to, there's something devaluing going on there, isn't there? In that autonomy, in that self-rule, because we do not rule ourselves well. God says, look, encourage love in the home by marrying well. Marry well. Do it in a way which pleases God. And if in the situation that the people are in, if a marriage breaks down, then still go through that well before God, who is full of understanding, full of compassion. But go through that well with God. And this thing about encouraging loving the home extends to the first year of marriage. And of course, if marriages are strengthened in this way, then they're a bit less likely to start falling apart and treating people as just objects to move around, or treating yourself as an object to move around, as in the first four verses. So you strengthen marriage and you stay at home. But note what it is that God's new society is to build into the marriage. Why stay at home? What's the so that here? Right, so that you can get the extension built before you go off to war and redecorate the kitchen and possibly put a new one in if you're a bit handy. What's the reason? The reason is, well, this is wonderful. The reason is so that you can bring happiness to your wife. Now, that's not bad for wives, and it's the biggest pleasure for husbands. Now, isn't that amazing that God gives a law which says to the rest of society, hands off, we want them to be happy. So the marriage is not simply a social contract which, you know, can bring two families together to unite their farms. It's not an economic thing that goes on. Actually, it takes us back to the delight of Adam when he saw Eve in the garden. It's for happiness. God wants us to be happy in our homes. Righteous, yes. Worthy, yes. Proper, yes. All those things. But he wants us to be happy. And he sees it as the job of a young husband to make his wife happy. Brilliant. So, if he's not doing, you can make his life miserable, can't you? Or something. And then after you've been around for long enough and she's got a bit fed up with you being around the house all the time, she can't get on with anything without having to be made happy by you. just buzz off and go and kill some Philistines with you and come back and make me happy again. So not only encouraging love in the home, but a spur to love and good works in the community, which obviously occupies the larger part of the passage, but will occupy not the larger part of our time together. So we just want to note what's going on here. Look at the values that are being encouraged. And I tried to sum them all up, and it seems to me that they go something like this. Verse 6 about the livelihood thing. What you're doing there is you're giving somebody the dignity of being able to provide for their family. You're giving somebody the dignity of doing work which provides a livelihood. Now, there is a lot to be said for cultivating dependence in the right way within the Christian fellowship. Carry one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. John Stott writes about that very, very helpfully and movingly in one of the chapters in Radical Disciple. It's our book of the month at the moment. But it seems to me that the livelihood issue in verse 6 is saying, look, respect somebody's dignity, honour their dignity by not taking their livelihood away as security for your debt or for the debt that you're owed. That is, do not put a legitimate claim on somebody's finances ahead of their dignity. The freedom thing in verse 7. If a man is caught kidnapping one of his brother Israelites and treats him as a slave or sells him, the kidnapper must die. Very strong sanction, isn't it? It doesn't get much stronger than that. And it's evil. And it's an evil which will infect the land, God says. Why? Because you're taking away someone's life, you're taking away their freedom, you're taking away their dignity, you're taking away the honour and respect which comes from being an Israelite, one of God's children. You're demeaning one of God's own people, whom God dignifies. It seems to me that verses 10 through 13 about property, which cover property in the when you're making a loan. It seems to me that the property thing there also has to do with treating one another with dignity, treating one another with compassion, treating one another with complete respect. Why would you not go into his house to get what he's offering as a pledge? Why would you not do that? Why would God say, don't go into his house?
Trust
is certainly part of it. Yeah? Why wouldn't you go into his house? Or why else wouldn't you go in? Why would you stay outside and let the man bring the pledge out to you? Because you're not debilitating the man. You're letting him still be an active agent in the thing. You're not plundering. You're not going in when his wife and family are there and sort of seizing what's his as if it was yours. He is allowed to preserve some self-respect, if you like, by going into the house and getting the cloak and bringing it out to you. You're not invading his home. You're just getting a cloak, for goodness sake. So you don't have to rub it in. You don't have to rub his nose in it. You don't have to make him squirm. Sure, he's in debt. That's bad enough. Don't make it worse. Honor the guy. Respect him. Treat him well. And if you know, fine, that he's poor, return his cloak. I mean, what use is the cloak to you anyway? And that tells us that the financial transaction that is being secured here is not as important as the man's well-being and dignity. And so God is teaching his people to have the same values that he has, that God has. And that's why it would be regarded as a righteous act in the sight of the Lord. That's the kind of thing God would do. Well, we know God does that kind of thing, doesn't he? Because Adam and Eve, he provided with garments when he put them out of Eden to cover their shame. That's love in action. And it seems to me that the financial needs of 14 and 15 are about preserving justice for people. Don't take an advantage of a hired man. Justice which protects people and makes sure that they can live decently. Pay him his wages each day before sunset because he is poor and is counting on it. Put yourself in his shoes. Anticipate his needs, even though you've hired him, even though he's just working for you, he's just an employee. Anticipate his needs, recognize that he's poor. He doesn't have the social power to come and demand something from you. He can't make you give it. You just have to give it. And it's only some love in the heart that's going to make you think like that. And then the righteousness issue, back a little bit to verses 8 and 9. Cleanliness, protecting cleanliness before the Lord. Again, this has to do with, in that same world, a sort of righteousness. Do the right thing by God. Don't be like Miriam. The example is there just to give weight to the point. We don't have the time to go back and read Numbers 12, but if you want to do that in your group, then you certainly do. And the sense of justice that we refer to 14 through 15, 14 and 15 is strengthened again, justice and provision with respect to the poor and needy in 17 through 22. So we get these four situations: the cloak, the harvesting in the field of the sheaf, the beating of the olives from the trees, and the gathering in and the harvesting of the grapes. Four situations where it would be so easy to put yourself first, where it would be so easy to become a profit maximizer, where it would be so easy to legitimize greed, to legitimize self first. Hey, that's my cloak, or that's my thing that, you know, the pledge is for. Or, that's my wheat there, thank you very much, in the fields. And those are my olives. I put in everything. That's my income, you know. That's my grapes. Hands off. Well, that's how the world out there thinks. isn't it? That's my oil. That's my income from the drugs. That's my profits. That's my salary from the share that's going to be agreed by the next shareholders meeting with my bonuses. Thank you. Hands off. You see, God doesn't want that amongst his people. So he wants you to work out how you can make do with enough. I mean, enough is enough. In such a way that everybody gets what they need. And that's the same for the aliens as well as for fellow Israelites. Because, as God says, that in verse 22 and also in verse 18, you were once aliens too, and look how God treated you. And that's why the 11th commandment is just so helpful, isn't it? Love one another as I have loved you. Well, you love one another and you love the aliens just as God has loved you. You were slaves. You know what it's like. God was good to you. You go out and be good too. Remember the story that Jesus told of the unmerciful servant who supervisor who went out having been forgiven a massive debt himself, went out and for peanuts made somebody who owed him some money squirm and suffer. So this love, you see, is always a God-oriented thing. It is never just social justice. It's never just humanitarianism. It's never just the horizontal set of relationships. It is always a God-oriented thing. So what happens when your society wants to take God out of its lawmaking? Well, you will reverse the directions of the laws so that you no longer have laws which encourage people to put others first. You will frame laws according to putting yourself first. And you will frame laws according to the principle of every man looking out for his own interests. I mean, goodness me, that's how we do elections, isn't it? But you will frame laws in a society where the mentality is let every man look to his own interests. The Bible says, let everyone look to the interests of others. So it is a complete reversal from the way that the Canaanites and the other Sixites were going to do it and have been doing it. It's a complete reversal from the way our ites do it nowadays. It comes from the heart. Over to you. You'll see the questions. And do look at some of those other passages if you feel you want to. Work through those questions. And I hope that you find some benefit in doing so. Thank you.